for Lickin' On Lending.
Welcome, everybody. Good to have you with us.
Welcome to Lickin' On Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news, all related to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Transformational Mortgage Solutions. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's your host of Lickin' On Lending, David Lickin.
Let's begin.
Welcome, everybody. It is Monday, September 20th, 2021. Again, this podcast is created by mortgage professionals. It is for mortgage professionals, as well as all the community that we already have. We're so grateful to have you as our listener. Again, our commitment to you is to bring you timely information in an audio format that you can listen to anytime, anywhere. As you regular listeners know, the first half of the podcast is dedicated to covering a lot of issues going on in the industry. And then we dedicate the hot topic segment to what is going on. And I am very excited about the hot topic segment today. You guys are in for a treat. We have back on the microphone Taylor Stork. He's a CMB, Certified Mortgage Banker, and then he is also the Chief Operating Officer at Developers Mortgage. We're going to be discussing a lot and focusing on servicing regulations, the mortgage environment, changes in the post-COVID world. So glad to have Taylor Stork joining us, and then we have another added surprise. Joining me on live on the microphone is Jack Nunnery, the past president of Texas Capital Bank, and he just retired. He's looking for something to do, so I invited him in today on this topic. Here's why. Because he, like Taylor, has a passion for our industry and has a strong, passionate opinion about many things going on in the industry. He couldn't talk about it when he was president of Texas Capital Bank because he's a banker. He works for a bank and all the different things that he has to avoid. But he's retired. He's coming out, so to speak, and joining us in the interview. And hopefully, maybe, just maybe, we might see a lot more of Jack in the future. But anyway, we're getting it started with this interview and the Hot Topic segment. Hey, make sure to get over to industrysyndicate.com. Listen to all the podcasts that are there. Great group of podcasts. Also, I'm joining up with Josh Pitts. Going to be working with him on another podcast. Very exciting things that are going on. The world of podcasting is growing, exploding. I was just looking at some recent statistics on podcasting. Folks, it's here. It's real. It's happening in a big, big way. That's why we have the sponsors we do, and we carefully select our sponsors. We have the Mortgage Bankers Association of America. We also have the Finastra Fusion Mortgage Bot Solution, marketing experience, and the power of fully integrated approach to the mortgage lending that simplifies the mortgage borrowing experience and streamlines the process for the employees. It's a great system, a wonderful tool, and they've been sponsors for so many, many years. And I'm just excited to share with you. Not only that, it's the thought leadership that they bring to the mortgage technology world. They're the third largest fintech company. And I said that the other day, and they go, I think we're now number two. We're thrilled to have Finastra as a sponsor. Also, Lenders One, as well as the Mortgage Collaborative. Both of these collaboratives are great ways for you to connect with your peers in a setting. You should have heard our guest, Taylor Stork, at the Lenders One conference. I sat in the audience and listened to him just absolutely rant on several issues. I go, God, I got to have him back. So that's why he's here today. And I think he too may become one of those voices you'll hear regularly on the podcast, because I love intelligent rants. We're going to get some of that. But when you go to these conferences, belong to one of these co-ops, you get a lot of great information. You're not going to get through the MBA through that. That is not to say you should join one of these in replace of the MBA. You should become a member of the MBA. You may not agree with everything they do and all the different positions they take. However, they are instrumental. We need to have one voice that goes in and on the Hill for us. And then support those, or allow your differences to be heard through the Lenders One as well as the Mortgage Collaborative. There's also another one out there, Community Mortgage Lenders of America. We're also pleased to have them as a sponsor. But when you're looking at technology, be sure to check out Incelerate. Josh Friend just did a really good webinar. I'm going to make sure for those of you that want to get a copy of the webinar that you missed last week, I believe it was last Thursday, it was good. Some of the statistics that go into Consumer Direct and the importance of how you connect with people was brought out in that podcast. Contact me and I'll make sure you get a link to that, or contact Josh Friend over at Incelerate by going to their website. Also, Knowledge Coop, really pleased with the learning management system that Tim Perry and the team has built. as well as Mobility, MMI, Mortgage Market Intelligence, and Modex. Both of these companies do a great job helping lenders connect with the right LOs with empirical data, really what's going on in the space. And finally, our newest sponsor, SnapDocs. Love these guys and what they're doing. Be sure to check out last week's interview. It was excellent and focused in on SnapDocs. And again, thank you to everyone at SnapDocs, especially Amy Moses, for their support of our podcast. And also special thank you goes out to Rob, Les, Alice, Alan, Matt, and joining us today, where the special thank goes out to Jack Nunnery. Let's get over to the MBA Mortgage Minute and hear what Rob Van Raphorst has recorded for us as an update from the MBA. Rob?
Hi, I'm Rob Van Raphorst. Welcome to the Mortgage Minute and the latest news from the Mortgage Bankers Association. Last week, the Treasury and FHFA announced that they are suspending certain limits on business activities of the GSEs. Specifically, this suspension removes artificial limits on GSE acquisitions of loans secured by second homes and investment properties, loans with multiple risk factors, and lenders' use of the cash windows. Multifamily lending volume caps were also eliminated. This announcement follows ongoing MBA engagement with Treasury and FHFA, including an MBA-led coalition letter highlighting the concerns with these limits shortly before they were suspended. And according to MBA's latest forbearance and call volume survey, the number of loans now in forbearance has decreased to 3% with an estimated 1.5 million homeowners in forbearance plans. That's it for this week. Thanks for joining me.
Appreciate it, Rob. Appreciate our partnership with the MBA and their support of the podcast, supporting what we're doing. But we're more excited about supporting everything that they're doing. If you want to see what's going on, the legislative content that is going up into the Hill where they're commenting, be sure to download the Mortgage Action Alliance app. You can do so in any of the app store and with your iPhone. And be sure to download and have your voice heard. If we are not having our voices heard, we can't complain about the regulation if you're not voting. And if you're not using these kind of technology, the MBA is doing a great job. Very pleased to have them. And we love them. Love what they're doing up there. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it very much. Now let's get over to our good friend, Les Parker. And by the way, Les's soundbite, how he always is working on the music. Well, today he did a really great job from the MBA convention. We have the concert every year. Well, this segment is from One Republic. So he's pulling some music out of the One Republic. And that's the group that's performing at the MBA. And so be sure to get signed up. I didn't say this earlier for the MBA because Les is going to be there and be joining us in our host space. So you can come on over and get to know us. But be sure to make sure you're signed up. Get a chance to see Les Parker. He'll be there at least for part of the conference. And we're excited about this. So Les Parker of TM Spotlight, what do you have for us this week?
TM Spotlight Soundbite is brought to you by PowerSeller, making hedging easy.
Who sees this like a swinging vine? Swing their heart across the line and get out now is flashing sign. Seek it out and ye shall find. Listen to the bulls counting stars. 1. Equity and treasuries watch trades reappointment star rise. 2. Cooling CPI gives the market room to wait for the Fed to taper. 3. The dollar supports investing in stocks and bonds. Mortgage bankers don't need to count stars since they remain sound asleep. With margins shrinking and modifications rising, when will they get out of the business? When they stop counting dollars, they'll be counting stars. These views are my own. Count stars at tmspotlight.com.
That's good. Parker, you did awesome. You and Gary Kentcher putting that little piece together. Excellent. And a great way to promote the conference. Again, I'm registered. We're going to have our special space so you can come over and get to know us and see us. I'll also be having my podcast equipment set up at the Empower event. Yep, I'm one of the guys that gets invited to Empower every year because we support that organization. We support what Marsha Davies and the group there at Empower within the MBA is doing. So very, very exciting. Good job. Anyway, Matt Graham, founder of MBS Live and CEO. Matt Graham is here with a pre-recorded message. He's busy and couldn't make it, but he did get time to send us in an update on the market. So, Matt, What you have for us, Fred?
This is Matt Graham with the MBS Live Market Update. Last week was an interesting one for the bond market and for the mortgage market specifically for a few different reasons. It began with a big rally following Tuesday's CPI data, Consumer Price Index. That was seen coming in slightly lower than the previous reading, but the actual reading was even lower than that. 4.0% at the core level versus a forecast calling for a 4.2% inflation increase. Those are huge numbers historically, but they are now declining after being in an accelerating trend for several months. So this could be the turning point in inflationary pressures that have some bond hawks worried. We'll see how that goes in upcoming inflation reports, but if that trend continues, it's good for the bond market, all other things being equal. And in this case, the modest miss was all it took for bonds to rally somewhat significantly, with 10-year yields dropping to the lowest levels in several weeks, down around 1.26. In the week's other economic data, retail sales on Thursday was probably the most significant development. It came out much stronger than expected at 0.7 versus a forecast of negative 0.8. That added to a negative momentum in the bond market that had really been intact ever since that CPI data came out. Bonds began pushing back in the other direction. And it's tough to say if there were organic reasons for that or if the market was simply following the prevailing consolidation pattern that's been intact since early August. For these purposes, consolidation means we have higher lows and lower highs, all other things being equal. In this case, it is actually a flat line resting over the highs. And that line in terms of 10-year yields is at 1.37, 1.38. That level became significant at the end of the week with yields testing it, trying to break up and out of that 1.3738 ceiling and ultimately failing and calming down just a little bit on Friday afternoon. Really, it sort of fizzled sideways after testing the highs early in the morning. One notable feature about that sell-off on Friday was that stocks were selling off as well. That's the type of behavior we often see when the overall financial market is preparing for Fed information, whether it's a Fed announcement, a speech from a key Fed member, usually Powell, and when the topic of accommodation is on the table, or quantitative easing, bond buying. That is relevant because coming up in the week ahead, we do have the Fed on Wednesday afternoon. It's a pretty big announcement. We're not expecting that they announce tapering. That would be a really big long shot in this case, but they may change the verbiage in such a way that makes tapering seem more imminent. Powell may say something about it in the press conference. And we also need to keep in mind that this is one of the four meetings per year where the Fed updates their economic projections. If you've heard of the dot plot, that's when the dots are released. That is the Fed members' way of forecasting where they see the Fed funds rate at various points in the future. And even though Fed Chair Powell persistently says, hey, this is an imperfect tool, it doesn't really have huge predictive value and it shouldn't move markets, markets nonetheless have a history of reacting to that almost every time and in a much bigger way than they react to other Fed meetings. In terms of non-economic data from last week, the most interesting development was the announcement from FHFA and Treasury that they were collectively rolling back the PSPA changes made in early 2021. What the heck does all that mean? PSPAs are the preferred stock purchase agreements, and that is the way that Treasury oversees, or Treasury and FHA oversee, the bailout or the conservatorship of Fannie and Freddie. That's the way that Calabria tried to sort of lock in his legacy before he left office and as the FHFA director, and he was attempting to make the path toward privatization of the GSEs harder to undo by the inbound administration. Why wasn't Calabria let go right when Biden took office? Because it wasn't yet clear that he could be fired until a Supreme Court decision later in the year finally made that a reality. That delay ended up being very important and causing a lot of drama for mortgage pricing because Fannie and Freddie weren't exactly eager to implement it because they knew that Calabria was probably on the way out, but they had to wait for the Supreme Court ruling. And at a certain point, they couldn't really wait any longer. And that's when they began to make calls to lenders saying, hey, if you send us more than 7% non-owner occupied and second home loans, we can't take them. And lenders rushed to increase their fees and their overlays on those types of loans, causing big pricing drama and quick overnight changes, oftentimes with no warning. So to recap, Treasury and FHFA changed PSPAs, resulting in Fannie and Freddie telling lenders that they basically had to raise fees for those loans. And now with those PSPA changes being rescinded for at least a year, lenders have the latitude to unwind those price changes, and many of them have already done so. Others will be doing so, most likely. The strategies will vary in that regard. It could happen in bits and pieces, but it is good news for clients who had gotten those loans who are potentially now in a position to refi, or clients that had held off on getting those loans because the price was prohibitive. So changes in the wind on seconds and non-owners. As far as the week ahead in terms of economic data, builder confidence is already out, slightly higher than expected this time, 76 versus 74. On Tuesday, we have construction numbers, housing starts and building permits, both seen roughly flat and in line with the last reading. Wednesday brings existing home sales, seen declining just a bit, but still at strong levels at 5.89 million versus nearly 6 million last time. And then on Friday, new home sales are seen rising just a hair from the previous reading, coming in at 715,000 versus 708 last time. But of course, the main event is Wednesday afternoon's Fed announcement, press conference, and the release of the economic projections, aka the dot plot. And that will be when we expect to see the biggest move of the week, Wednesday afternoon and then Thursday morning. Last but not least, Evergrande. What's that? Chinese real estate development company, the second biggest there, and a big constituent in offshore Chinese equities markets, which have tanked overnight, and there is buzz about global systemic issues relating to Evergrande because they owe a lot of people money and they're not going to be able to pay it back. And this is a topic that the bond market is discussing, but it is not necessarily a Lehman Brothers moment for the global financial market, best people can tell right now. It is definitely the topic of the day and something that we'll be keeping an eye on MBS Live from here on out. As always, keep in mind that Lickin' on Lending listeners get the extended free trial, no credit card requirement on mbslive.net by entering in the code LOL in the sign-up screen. That's all for now. We'll be back with you on Monday to break down the market reaction to the Fed announcement, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Appreciate Matt. You recording that. It's always fun to have him on here. So anyway, Matt, great job. By the way, go sign up for the service. And I turned on Matt's website, got MBS Live up and running here this morning when I first walked in, and I saw the article, the interview on CNBC, where they're talking about they need to look into the Federal Reserve's ethics related to their personal investing. That got my attention. I went and listened to it. Folks, you got to go listen to that. Now let's move over to Alice Alvey. Alice is CMB Vice President of Education and Training at Union Home Mortgage. We love Union Home Mortgage. They let us have her on here. Alice, good to have you here, friend.
Thanks, Dave. Well, and actually today I'm going to talk a little bit about the agency. So I'm glad that Matt went into detail about the changes in the PSPA and the removal of the cap, which he talked about, as well as the loan level price adjustment. So hopefully everyone's feeling that relief in the market for second homes and non-owner occupied. So I'm glad that he was able listen to that. He gave a really great context and background on that one. So what I wanted to focus on today was today is the day that the average middle credit score option in DU goes into effect. Mm. There seems to be a lot of buzz in the industry, and I was thinking a lot about the loans that are actually going to be impacted by this and how loan officers are treating this. Fannie Mae, for those of you who aren't aware, they're a credit score is not, by their definition, an integral part of the risk assessment, because DU really pulls its own credit info to ultimately make the decision. They use the credit score to ensure compliance with the 620 minimum requirement they have. So as they want to try and expand home ownership, so as part of that initiative, they are offering lenders the option to use an average middle credit score. So what that does is if I've got a borrower whose scores are, one borrower's middle score is 619, and another borrower's middle score is 693, I would average those two to come up with 656 to be able to say, okay, the loan meets Fannie's minimum 620 requirement. What ultimately that means is this borrower with the 619 middle score, who you normally may have had to say, I have to leave you off the loan, you're now going to be able to talk to that co-borrower and say, I can leave you on the loan. In a lot of cases, though, there are going to be price hits for that choice to leave that borrower on, because it doesn't change pricing. This is only going to help influence some of the main criteria for eligibility. Representative scores don't go away for pricing. Mm-hmm. They don't go away for most of the MI companies. Arch MI, I have heard, is on board. I apologize for any other MI company that may be on board, and I'm not saying their name, but please, everybody, check with your MI companies to see who's on board. And I think, though, the challenge is going to be that conversation with borrowers to say, I can leave you on the loan. If I don't need your income, then it's a choice. However, if I leave you on, your pricing is going to be X. If you're not on the loan, your pricing is Y. So you'll have some challenges you'll have to walk through, making sure those conversations are held fairly and in compliance with all the regulations on how that's represented to the customer. Certainly for the times where you need that borrower on the loan with income, because you need their income on the loan, then this can help deals work that may not have otherwise gone conventional. So really, people are looking at this as a play of, well, I have fewer loans that have to go to FHA, and I'll be able to offer the borrower a conventional. Every lender is going to be different as to how much this impacts their customer base. So as a lender, we have to choose, are we all in and we're going to use the average credit score on all our loans, or I don't use it at all. It isn't really a pick and choose, hey, it works great for this loan, but I don't need it on this other loan kind of thing. It really is a you choose, and then that'll be the method that you use as a company. So it's a lot of buzz today. I think a lot of companies are playing with the numbers. Mathematically, you can have one borrower with a score in the very low 500s middle score, and your other borrower could be in the mid 700s, and now that average really works to bring that middle 500 back up. So people are playing around with their deals today, Dave, to see what's going to work and what's not with the new Fannie Mae DU average credit score.
What is this telling you? Is this going to open the credit box a bit more? It would seem that it's going to. Alice,
yeah, I think it will open it a little bit to including a borrower on a loan who might otherwise have been left off. Now, statistically, having two borrowers on a loan for most lenders in their risk profile means I've got a better chance in collection, right? It's easier to work with two people than one. So from a risk analysis standpoint, that's an important factor. If I had a husband and wife and I was going to have to leave one of them off, they're still living in the house together. It's still the same finance bucket, right?
Yeah.
So why not have the other person on the loan to help manage that risk and servicing a little bit better? Others are not so sure and maybe looking at it differently. So my gut is it's great. Let's let the other person be on the loan, because it usually means a little slightly lower risk, again, in some customer profiles.
Very good. Excellent. Alice, so appreciate you being here, Alice, each and every week. And I know you got to run today, but have a great rest of the week. Great. Bill, Al, and the whole team there at Union Home, and how much we respect them, appreciate them for you being allowing you to break away each week to be a part of the podcast. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, they're a terrific team to work with. And I think I will say we'll watch this week, and I'll talk more about it next week to see what's really happening in the market as it unfolds. So thanks, Dave. Thanks, everyone.
Alan Pollack's here, another popular segment that we run each week with a tech update. Alan, good to have you here, friend.
Great to be here, as always. I do have a great topic. I know it's something that makes everyone want to scratch the itch, which is Inbox Zero. So, David, how do you handle Inbox Zero today?
That's a fantasy. Inbox Zero is fantasy.
Right.
There is no way.
That's exactly right. Well, it is impossible. We probably all Googled it, searched it, read articles. Every major newspaper or news outlet online has talked about it. It is really tough. Maybe I have solved everyone's woes. So Inbox Zero could be as simple as, and I've read this article, by the way, on Zapier, because, again, I was trying to figure out how to get to Inbox Zero. And there are companies that you can hire that will go through your emails. But in this kind of business, it's hard to do that. It's kind of like an email personal assistant, because we have such sensitive information and they're not part of your organization. But you can create a folder calling internal emails. You can create another folder called external emails. and use rules and just simply sniff out all of the emails that are from your internal teams into that folder and then everything else to the other folder. Taking a baby step, doing just that. So I did it this morning and my inbox is left with all the stuff in the middle. And my internal email box is now segmented from my other. We'll see how long it lasts, but I'll report back next week. How's that? Good. What they basically said, by the way, in the article is by trying to achieve inbox zero, if you were to just filter out a couple things or you only prioritize a few things, you're never going to reach the goal. You've got to filter out everything. So yeah. I'll report back next week.
If I ever see my inbox at a zero, I got hacked and someone went and did a dastardly deed in deleting everything, and that would be devastating. Anyway, moving on.
We should create the inbox zero malware bug and send it out, and everyone will take the day off. It'll be great. So anyways, TechCrunch, they just announced, for anyone that follows, TechCrunch Battlefield, it's a $100,000 equity feed prize money. If you win, there's only a 1.5% acceptance rate. The 20 startups that are going to be in the battlefield were just announced today, and it goes from lithium batteries to chemical recycling to smart media, even to sub-Saharan African fintech and cultured meat production. So where am I going with all that? If you follow it and you like fintech and unicorn type companies and all that great stuff, you want to check it out. Many, many years ago, I think it was 2016 or 2017, Matic Insurance, and I think they were a winner of the TechCrunch Battlefield. So that's why I bring it up. They do sometimes have fintech mortgage related companies in there. David, we talk about home buyers, right? We talk about how to cultivate the right design for them. There's even designing digital banking experiences that put people first. I'm going to read the subject of this and then tell you about NerdWallet. So it says, purposefully designing digital experiences to fit existing banking processes and platforms makes sense from a technology perspective, but not from a people perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not putting people first. We're putting technology and how we like to innovate and see something work first. And it was very interesting because I saw that. And then I saw this from NerdWallet, 67% of homeowners who have bought a home in the last 5 years have regrets about their purchase. It's a new survey they did. Get that, 67%. So they polled 2,063 people, 450 had purchased a home in the last 5 years. And the most common theme that they found was borrowers suggested a win-at-all-cost attitude coupled with the low, low, low inventory and the amount of bidding wars that went on for each home. And that's why there's this regret. It also found that 15% of buyers said the home ended up being too small. 10% said the commute was too long. 15% the mortgage payment was too high. And 16% underestimated the total cost of ownership. If you look at just two items, right? 15% said the mortgage payment was too high. And 16% underestimated the total cost of ownership, right? That's over 30%. 31% of the people in that survey that we could have changed from our perspective of how this industry works, we could have changed their expectations or helped them be in a better situation. So putting people first, and as you design and think of technology, it's so important. Remember, we're never going to be able to remove loan officers. It's the human touch that helps get homeowners to that position. So it's all just so, so important. A couple other little things in the news here, David. BeSmarty offers lenders a best-in-class closing experience with, guess who? SnapDocs, one of our new sponsors and a good friend of the program now. And second is Stewart Title has acquired Informative Research for $192 million. Yeah.
Yes. I couldn't believe that. Unfortunately, I know Sean who's the third generation owner of the company, and that they were proud in the fact that it was a family held company for three generations. And they moved the whole company out of Southern California, Garden Grove, and I think it's where it was at and where it was for decades, and then brought it to Dallas area and then just sold it. Interesting.
Yes. Two more super quick things. Radian launches blockchain back title offering. They call it Title Genius. Debuted in Florida. It's now available in Arizona, California, Nevada, Ohio, Pennsylvania. I can't say that backwards, sorry. And it's saying that it's now blockchain enabled, and home buyers, it used to be a black hole. Now they access this blockchain portal where they can shop and save on title and closing services directly. I'm not really sure how that all works. Maybe it just sits on blockchain. I'll have to look more into it, but I thought that was interesting as we talk about blockchain. And if you remember last week, we talked briefly about build versus buy, and I said I would talk more about it this week. One thing I want to bring up, and I'll give you a little tidbits, you have to still do QA, whether you build it or you buy it. QA is absolutely vital. Imagine getting on the phone with a borrower and giving them the wrong information because somebody didn't follow through and verify that what you have worked or didn't work the right way. So whether you build or buy, if you're still on the brink of that decision, quality assurance is the most absolute critical aspect. And the project manager that I mentioned that you have to have, whether you build versus buy, it doesn't matter. You need to have that person shepherd a plan on what you're going to have and what you're going to test. So build versus buy, it's not a simple decision. There's definitely, next week we can actually talk about cost comparisons and development teams. But last week we talked about how you still need to have a tech team. And this week I just brought up that QA is still so absolutely important. With that, David, that's this week's tech update. Other than that, I look forward to the hot topic.
Yeah, appreciate you being here, friend. Well, listeners, that wraps up the weekly mortgage updates. If you're listening live, just stay right here. We're going to go right on into our hot topic segment. But if you're listening on a downloaded basis, which probably the vast majority of you do, you're just going to want to move on to the next podcast, which is going to be broken out and set up as a separate episode. So now we're going to head over to the hot topic. So here we go. Welcome, everybody, to the Lincoln on Lending Hot Topic segment. So excited to have you here. It is September 20th. And we have a special guest joining us here today, actually two special guests. Our special guest on the Hot Topic segment is Taylor Stork, Certified Mortgage Banker, Chief Operating Officer for Developers Mortgage. You heard him on. He gave us some insights into his brilliance and his passion and his soapbox expound on topics when he was on with us. We were at the Lenders One conference. And then I got to sit in these sessions, and I listened to Taylor again, just getting on and doing some rants on some topics. And I go, man, I want to record that. Wait a minute. I have a podcast. I can bring them on live. So we're bringing back Taylor Stark. Taylor, so good to have you here with us.
Hey, Dave. I'm glad to be here.
Joining me on the microphone today is a long-standing friend and a client, but more friend. I got to work with him when he was at Texas Capital Bank. I'm speaking of none other than Jack Nunnery, who recently retired. Heard me talk about that if you listen to the first part of the podcast. But Jack Nunnery, good to have you on the podcast here with me. We talked about this. You joining me here, and you're here.
Well, thank you, David, and I'm excited to be here with you.
Yeah, we should say we had Jack on as a guest when he was at Texas Capital Bank. It was on May 20th, 2019, and you did a segment interview on us. Are you prepared for digital mortgage solutions? That was a great, and looking at the downloads of that one, it's still a popular podcast, and I think it's relevant, Jack. So you always stay relevant, and I'm really excited to have you join in. And Jack, we were talking before this. You got excited about the questions we're going to be talking with Taylor about, and because it's so relevant. We have five primary questions we're going to try to go through. I'm telling everyone, I'm speaking on this coming Friday in Houston, and I'm going to be using this hot topic segment as my content because there's so much good packed in here. So Taylor, let's get into it. And we're talking about CRAs for IMBs, and we've recently heard the Treasury, as well as the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, NCRC, they both suggested a need for CRA requirements for IMBs. And there's three states, Massachusetts, Illinois, and New York, that have implemented or are in the process of implementing some of this. So, wow, how does this address the racial inequality and the wealth gap? And how does it affect, most importantly, the IMBs, many of whom are loyal listeners?
So this is a very interesting topic, and I think we're going to hear more and more and more and more about this. I had a chance to hear Dave Stevens talk about it last week on a CMB call.
Yeah, he's good. He's always got good commentary on that, and I would love to go back, and we need to get a link in our show notes. We'll find that, folks, and get a link to that interview. If you could find that, Taylor, so we could share that interview with our listeners, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. CRA is an interesting animal. First and foremost, let me just say out of the gate that I think CRA is a great thing, particularly based on the CRA, the programs that were put together in the 70s and still do have in many ways some real fundamental issues to address as a country. We had banks that would go into a marketplace and they would take money out of that marketplace in the form of deposits. They would get insurance from the FDIC to protect those deposits. They would have access to the federal home loan banking system to borrow money at extraordinarily cheap rates, but then they would only lend their money back into certain neighborhoods that were generally much more affluent. And if you look at maps today, you take like St. Louis, for example, if you take old CRA redlining maps from pre-1970 and compare that to the maps today of where low to moderate income tracts are located, they're virtually a mirror image. So CRA was created to make sure that banks reinvested those dollars back into the communities that needed them most. And so I think CRA is a great thing.
It was created for a good reason, and it started in the Carter administration. If you go way back, the reason I did a big dive into this, and I was on Fox News with Huckabee back when Huckabee had his segment, and I was really interested about that. But where things went wrong was in the Clinton administration, where they started using this, and things started heading in a direction to expand home ownership that wasn't so good and got us ultimately, I think, one of the factors that led into the crisis, the housing crisis.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more. And so looking at CRA for IMBs, and I understand why agencies are looking at this. Massachusetts passed a law and is enforcing it right now. Illinois passed a law and is enforcing right now. New York, they've passed the legislation. It's waiting for the governor's signature, depending on who the governor is today.
That's
so
true.
Here's the issue with CRA for IMBs. And these are my concerns. When you take a look at the IMB model, IMBs aren't taking deposits out of a community. They aren't benefiting from the FDIC's insurance. They aren't benefiting from access to the federal home loan banking system window. And you couple that with the fact that the Urban Institute recently came out and basically said that IMBs are by far and away the greatest source of access to credit for low to moderate income borrowers. They published it in their reports. It was well researched and well documented in the IMB report that was put out by CHLA recently. So look at the fact that right now today, IMBs are doing the vast majority of lending for borrowers in the communities that the CRA proposals would otherwise target. We're already solving the need. We're already making the loans. It's the one and only thing we all do in order to make a living for our companies, right?
Right.
So what exactly does adding new regulation and new compliance burdens actually accomplish? That becomes the better question. I think there's probably 10 different ways to debate this issue. You can debate it on studies. You can debate it on statistics. You can debate it on all kinds of different things. But at the end of the day, I would suggest that the focus of, because ultimately, whether it's a regulation or any other initiative, ultimately it's going to cost money, right? They're going to put resources into managing it. Bureaucrats do what they love to do. Politicians do what they're good at doing, which is pass laws and then attempt to enforce them. How do you enforce those laws? Typically, you enforce them in the mortgage space through exams, regulatory reviews. Sometimes they result in fines or different types of admonishments. So the question becomes, if you have an IMB system that is already leading the way in this area of lending, does it make sense to add more compliance and administrative burden to small, privately owned, independent companies that generally don't have huge compliance departments in the first place?
Now, is it going to have the unintended consequence? Jack, you know CRA. You were in a bank for years.
Yeah, certainly, David. I sat on a fair lending CRA committee at the bank that I work for. And you know what really raises my eyebrows here is CRA coupled with fair lending, right? Because we're regulated by fair lending in the independent mortgage banking community. So when does the questions begin to get asked that says, well, we have the CRA requirement. We have measured you against it, IMB. You are deficient. You need to start advertising on media in markets that are the low to median income markets. So, Taylor, not only is it the administrative cost of preparing for exams and monitoring your progress against the reg, when you fold this into fair lending, it even becomes more of a challenge to the extent that, well, the reason for your numbers in these target assessment areas, census tracts, is because you're not advertising, you're not putting flyers in front of the low to median or moderate income borrowers. So now you've got this whole exercise changing your marketing approach so that you would have success in an LMI market.
Jack, I'm so glad you brought up marketing because I want to touch on that. And I think there's some things here that we need to bring together. So right now, today, up and down the East Coast, there are states that require loan officers to live within 100 miles of the branch that they work for. So I want you to think about that for a second. We know, just from having been in this business for a long time, most of the people that you end up doing mortgages for are going to be people that you have some level of relationship with, right? So maybe that's a referral through a realtor. Maybe that is somebody that through your church. Maybe it's somebody that because you're part of a particular community. People tend to work with loan officers, at least that are somehow connected to us and our community and are local to us. So here becomes the challenge. If I have a company that is located in, I don't know, pick a state, Ohio, and if that company is licensed to do loans in Pennsylvania, but can't hire a loan officer in Pennsylvania, company doesn't have a branch within 90 miles from that loan officer, meaning that loan officer is not allowed to work remotely. They have to be out of the corporate office. How does an Ohio loan officer create a personal community relationship with a borrower in a low to moderate income community in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I think that personal connection is very important to the LMI borrower.
It's interesting, this topic. Dan Carson and I were talking about this earlier today, and the importance of the loan officer. He's with Illibid Mortgage and one of their top producers there and runs the region. And it was really interesting. So you've raised some great questions. The bottom line is CRA is potentially happening. I want to wrap it up with this one question. What did the MBA and what did you hear? Or what are they doing about this? What's their position on it? I kind of guess and assume. Taylor, what did you hear when you heard Stevens on this?
Well, so first and foremost, Stevens no longer represents the MBA, right? He's now a private citizen doing his thing. The impression that I got from the MBA actually came out of a panel that I attended on this topic or on several topics at the Lenders One Summit in Orlando recently. And the impression I got was that this is a state level issue and the state level organizations need to focus on calls for action and advocacy at the state level regulators. Offices and so forth. But it's not a state level issue because this is a trend that is sweeping the country. And we see it happening in New York right now. We see New York, they've passed legislation. They just haven't signed it into law. And I have concerns. Hmm. The flip side of this, Dave, before we wrap up, is I think there's actually a better way to approach this. Rather than adding regulatory burden saying, hey, we're going to examine you. And if you don't do better than X, you're going to get in trouble. Here's the biggest issue. Getting back to the point that I made a moment ago about the marketing and the sales and the fact that people do business with people they know and that are from the community. Here's what we really need to do. What we really need to do is focus on generating new loan officers in this business that come from the communities that need to be served in the first place. Right.
Stupid.
Because that's where the business is actually going to come from. These borrowers, regardless of which segment of society they come from, borrowers don't walk into mortgage offices and apply for mortgages. Maybe they did once upon a time. They certainly don't walk into my office. The transactions that we obtain, and certainly they walk into banks. That's a whole different business model. But in the IMB space, it's mostly relationship based or it's computer advertising and direct mail based. Right. So there's kind of two different models. The relationship-based model, these borrowers aren't walking into the office saying, hey, I'm here, I want to apply. These are generally referrals. So if you want to put more capital into the community in the form of lending to low to moderate income borrowers and low to moderate income tracts, we need to put more loan officers in those marketplaces. We need to make it easier for loan officers to get licensed. And we need to make it easier for loan officers to participate in the business by removing restrictions from having them live close to a branch office. And in some states, mandating that they only actually accept the loan application while they are physically in the branch office that they work for, which may be nowhere near the borrower's community in the first place.
See, David, therein lies a very important intermediate to long-term strategy for independent mortgage bankers, is we talked about diversity in the workplace. Now we need diversity in our loan officer, because that's going to help penetrate these LMI markets. And of course, we all want to serve the underserved, but you know, keep in mind that if you have an LMI loan and you're selling to a correspondent aggregator, oftentimes you're going to get 75 to 125 basis points better execution on that LMI loan, because correspondent aggregators are typically banks. And banks view this as a way to help their own CRA numbers is by buying LMI loans from originators. So you got a financial reward that goes along with diversifying your loan officer mix as well.
I want to get on to the next topic because there's so much here. One of the things I enjoyed was you always come up with suggestions. You identify the problem and you always come up in your rant and say, now here's what we need to do about it. You had some great points there, and Jack just reinforced them. I think you've got some great suggestions in there. And the story about St. Louis, I have a client that's a bank that acquired another bank that did a lot of CRA lending in there. And we got in and studied that extensively. Boy, were you right. It is CRA is a great initiative. We need to stay at the heart of it and not do what the federal government is aiming for. We're from the federal government, and we're here to help you. Anyway, let's get to servicing regulations. Conference of State Bank Supervisors, the CSBS, has proposed more strategic regulations for servicers, which would open them up to new and more stringent oversight at the state level. At the same time, Jenny May has proposed changing the increased balance sheet reserve requirements for servicing eligibility for government loans. So let's get into discussion. How will these two proposals impact the availability of credit to Americans and the ultimate impact on IMBs? I'm very interested in your perspective. Start your rant.
Oh, my God. All right. So this ties right back into the concept of CRA in the first place. Look, I absolutely believe, and I think most people probably believe, that we have a wealth gap, that we have to address it. There's a lot that we can do. I want to be part of doing the things we can do. But let's take a look at how these different policies impact that wealth gap, right? So if you look at servicing, and I understand the concern. The concern is that a small handful of very large IMBs are beginning to get a large concentration in servicing assets, that large concentration can create systemic risk. And P.S., by the way, I'm not saying that's not true. There is definitely the potential for systemic risk. There are ways to mitigate it. And Fannie and Freddie are the master servicers. They can pull the servicing anytime they want to. So there are tools and levers in place to protect against the risk. But sure, there's risk. But what we're talking about from the CSBS is not focused on the big 15. They're IMBs, but they're really not IMBs the way that you and I think of IMBs. They're generally publicly held companies or owned by billionaires or backed by private capital from Wall Street. So when you talk about your typical IMB, the privately, independently owned and operated in a mortgage bank, what we're talking about is really the bread and butter of the mortgage business. So if you take a look at servicing, and if you make it more and more difficult for IMBs to service loans and retain servicing on loans, what you're ultimately doing by lumping them in with the big 15 or the big 10 or the big 5 or the big whatever, what you're ultimately doing is you're increasing the cost and the burden of servicing on the smaller IMB. So what does that do? What that does is it encourages IMBs to exit the servicing business entirely. And as they exit the business, you're going to see an increased concentration of that servicing amongst the big 5, 10, or 15, thus therefore reinforcing and creating a self-fulfilling prophecy that actually creates greater concentrated systemic risk. And what does that do for the borrower? Here's what it does. As servicing is held by fewer IMBs, and more of the large companies, the value of that servicing is fundamentally going to get smaller, right? Because you have fewer buyers. It's basic supply-demand economics. I'm not an economist and I'm not a politician, but basic rules here go into effect that says if fewer people want this thing, then it's less valuable. If it's less valuable, you'll pay less money for it. If you pay less money for it, that's going to translate through to the borrower in the form of a higher interest rate. Right? Because the less a loan is worth, the higher interest rate the borrower ultimately receives for it. By creating higher interest rates for borrowers, what are we doing? We're pushing higher costs all the way through the system, ultimately to the borrower that is in the LMIT and LMIB category, the low to moderate income borrower, low to moderate income category, the very borrower that we're trying to increase access to credit to through the CRA initiatives. So the idea that the left hand of our political machine and bureaucratic machine and regulatory machines is saying we need to make servicing more complicated and more expensive, and the right hand is saying, oh, we need to do these other things, it's just confounding to me. And I'd love to hear Jack's thoughts on it, because sometimes it makes me twist my head sideways and I don't know where to go from there.
Well, let's open the door, Jack. What do you think about all that?
Well, I'm especially concerned about this, Taylor, because we've already seen patterns over the years where Ginnie Mae servicing becomes highly illiquid in the marketplace and very difficult to trade. And when you start whittling down the number of participants in the Ginnie Mae market, I think all you do is undermine the liquidity associated with the Ginnie Mae servicing asset. And at some point, we're going to be down to four or five, as you said, mega independent mortgage banks, publicly traded, that are out there, you know, looking to continue to acquire Ginnie Mae servicing. Certainly money center banks are not leading the way here, and I wouldn't look for them to come back in the market if there was a weakening in the number of smaller IMBs that could service Ginnie Mae loans. So I think you put the whole market at risk if you begin to pair off mortgage bankers that wanted to participate and service Ginnie Mae loans but now can't because of the 250% capital risk weight.
Jack, you brought up the banks, and I think you bring up a good point that I overlooked and failed to mention. We already drove the banks out of the business. We fundamentally told them to leave, right? So first we attacked them with False Claims Act lawsuits or potential lawsuits, and we watched Chase go, okay, we're out. We don't want to face false claims. That's treble damages based on a law that goes back to selling donkeys to the Union Army in 1862, I think, or something thereabouts. Then we said, well, Basel III, let's change the rules on how banks can even book these assets. And the rest of them said, okay, well, we don't want to, we can't book the asset anymore, so we better get out. And so the banks have led the way exiting FHA lending because of the constraints that we put in place. It's one of the main reasons that IMBs have had the opportunity to step up to the plate and become the leading lenders in the low to moderate income areas, because a lot of low to moderate income borrowers take FHA loans. We solve that problem for the marketplace. We fill that gap. But if you make it more difficult to retain servicing, you're going to make the loans that IMBs do less valuable, which makes the interest rates that those very borrowers receive go higher, which makes it harder for those borrowers to borrow money and buy houses, which is going to continue to contribute to the massive wealth gap where a white homeowner, what's the statistic that came out from MBA this morning or yesterday? They have five times more assets, five times more net worth than a homeowner of African-American descent, I think is the number that came out from MBA this morning on their announcement. We have to break that cycle. And breaking that cycle happens by making more loans and having more participation in the marketplace, not less.
And how do you drive people out of it? It's regulations. You bring in more regulations, you get more auditors going, and finally, you just do what the banks did. You're like, screw it, I'm out.
Banks aren't going to come back at 250% capital risk weight. Look, inside of a bank, and I've worked for banks, inside of a bank, it's all about your return on equity. Your biggest competition is not who competes with you outside your door. It's the division that's located right down the hallway from you.
That's
and if you have a 18% ROE, and they've got a 32% ROE, the bank should, in the interest of their shareholders, be allocating resources to the business with the higher ROE. And at 250% risk weight, you're crushing the bank's return on equity. But the one thing about this is, if this were to become law, can you imagine the amount of servicing that would be dumped in the marketplace in a short amount of time, and what that would do to the underlying values of Ginnie Mae MSRs?
Yeah, we crash the system. I mean, it's the unintended corrections when we start trying to just oversteer, and I think that's what's going on. I want to move on to one of the other ones, which I thought was really good, is you brought up the question. So from your perspective, what should lenders do to prepare for, and how can they ensure success in the post-COVID world?
Wait, I thought I was asking that question. I was hoping I was going to get the answer out of you. What do I do next?
Jack and I have some opinions on that, but how are you preparing?
It's a moving target, to say the least. I think that technology is going to be a huge, huge, huge impact on us like it never has been before.
Right.
I think that we're going to get much better at doing things virtually. I think that we're going to have to find ways to streamline our operations so that the businesses can fundamentally be sound. We can't support a mortgage industry if it costs $8,000 to manufacture a mortgage.
Right.
And in a model where we have one or two or three credit decisions being made in a day by an underwriter, where the same underwriters are earning exorbitant salaries. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the money isn't earned and deserved. What I am suggesting is our fundamental process needs to be overhauled so that it can be more efficient across the board, so that we can drive the expenses down, so that we can serve more borrowers, and we can put people into homes more quickly and more easily at a lower cost to the borrowers themselves. So I think the biggest thing that I'm trying to keep my eye on post-COVID is It's a couple of things. One is how to drive expenses down for manufacturing mortgages. Two is the ever-changing need for products. I think that we're going to see a new focus on alternative products, niche things in the non-qualified mortgage space, things within the agencies in the kind of niche space within the agencies, from HECM purchases to home style renovations, 203K, Home Ready, Home Possible. I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity, particularly as we see this housing market just get itself exhausted, working its way through capacity and supply. I think that we're going to see a lot more creativity on the part of originators, niche products, both non-QM and agency products, to bring buyers into the market that hadn't necessarily been a buyer 2 years ago, or to create inventory opportunities that otherwise didn't exist, such as 203K home lending and home style home lending. So I think those are going to be major things to watch out for in the next 18 months.
Now, I want to move right into the fourth point is envisioning technology and the changes that are happening. What's capturing your attention out there right now, and what are you envisioning how technology is going to change the industry from your perspective?
I'm not the expert on this, but in my opinion, there are fundamentally two things that slow down a mortgage. The first one is right this minute, getting that appraisal done. And I'm hearing horror stories of appraisals taking 6 weeks, 8 weeks in some marketplaces, as well as appraisers themselves marking up the appraisal costs to $600, $800, just ludicrous numbers because of a fundamental shortage of appraisers and a fundamental shortage of capacity. The second thing is we still, even to this day, after years and years and, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years, our fundamental process to process, manufacture, and close a mortgage is that we stare and compare documents. I look at a document, I look at another document, I say, yeah, they both look the same, and then I check a box, and then I pull out the next set of documents and look at one and look at the other and say, yeah, they both look the same, and check a box, right? We do stare and compare. And a lot of the delay from the day you apply for a loan to the day you get it closed is ultimately related to getting in line to be stared and compared at, or getting in line to one day have your appraisal done, right? So I think that technology that's going to have the biggest impact is not going to be foofy looking websites. It's not going to be super sophisticated marketing systems. I think that the thing that's going to be impactful for us in the next 18 months, I hope, is going to be using OCR to look at some documents, using AI to do some of the comparing, simplifying the process of stare and compare so that our workforce can focus more on their knowledge instead of just their eyeballs, and actually process through more ultimate work product. And I think the same thing can be said about the appraisal process. There are some really neat tools that exist that I think we'll start to see getting applied into the appraisal space that enables a house or an apartment, a condo, whatever, to work its way through the valuation process itself more quickly and using more automated tools than have historically been the case. And if we can employ those at the front end of a transaction, I think we can get that transaction through half of the process a whole lot faster, if not through the entire process a whole lot faster. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Good. Jack, we've talked about stare and compare. When you brought me in to help you build the correspondent lending division there at Texas Capital Bank, which, by the way, is now over at Andy Peach at PHH. He sold that as you exited. We talked a lot about this. So your comments on this.
Well, I would agree with Taylor. If you're not already using optical character recognition and some level of analytics to compare data lifted from field A or field number 53 or in field 182, I think you're behind the curve and getting further behind the curve. So if your technology provider does not have an OCR solution that allows for comparative analysis of data entered into different fields, then you really need to push your technology provider to get that functionality to you. But David, one of the things that we did, and I thought it was really interesting, is as we took a look at our process and put time elements to it, like how long does it take to calculate income on a borrower? Where is your process consuming the most time and the most dollars? Now where you should be trying to apply technology to, right? And so we did a complete analysis of our processes and understood the actors that were going to be fulfilling that part of the process. So we were able to do a cost analysis through the whole mortgage origination process.
Yeah,
I thought that was particularly valuable because now I know where to apply technology to. So technology is great. Process engineering is great. But when you combine the two together, now you get excellence.
Yep. That's a great point. You did some very innovative things there within the division. I want to go to what...
I only want to come back if Jack's on, because he always seems to agree with the stuff I say, which that works for me.
I love when Jack disagrees with me, because it is a great conversation. He always does so respectfully, but it is really fun to see his perspective. So hopefully we'll have him back on a very, very regular basis. We're going to have you back. But I want to wrap it up with this last question is, where should originators be investing their time and resources? I loved you when we talked about getting preparing for this podcast, but share with our listeners, where should originators be investing their time and resources?
I think there's two different questions here built into one, right? So originators
yeah.
are companies and originators are loan officers.
Right, right.
And I want to make sure I distinguish between the two. Back to Jack's point, you may be a gigantic organization with millions of dollars in budget to go out and do process flow review. You may be a tiny mom and pop shop where two or three people fundamentally run the entire company. It doesn't really matter your size. You have to invest your time into looking at your workflow and determining where your hangups are and then solving those hangups. And it means you got to invest, if not money, time in reviewing the technologies that are out there. And sometimes it's not even the technologies. Sometimes it's just cleaning up your flow, to be candid. There's a lot of flow in a lot of places that can be fundamentally cleaned up. But I think that as companies, large and small, it's going to become more and more important that we close loans efficiently than it has been in the past. Because I do think that we're going to see margins compress. I do think that there's going to be greater competition for every single deal. I do think that we're going to see that, I don't know if it's next month or next year or sometime in our lifetime, but it's going to happen and we need to be prepared for it. And it's the company that's prepared for it that can be resilient through the compression or through the change so that when they come out on the other end of it, they can take advantage of market opportunities, right? Because the market opportunity is the company that wasn't prepared for it. As far as loan officers go, if I'm a loan officer, I'm focused on a couple of different things. My number one thing is strengthening my network. All day long, every single day, being in touch, staying in touch, proactively reaching out to people. But the second thing is really education. And I know that just saying the word education probably doesn't really say a lot, but if I'm a loan officer, I'm learning everything I can learn about product. I'm learning everything I can learn about the guidelines, because the truth is there's a lot of nuance that we've just been able to overlook for the last several years in an environment where we've seen interest rates in the twos. And when interest rates are in the fours and the fives and the sixes, as they may one day be, it's going to be important that you have a better network than your competitor. And that's how you distinguish yourself in what I think is going to become more of a knowledge worker business than it has been in years past.
Back to the future comes to mind, because this is what has been fundamental in the industry all along. But I think what you're saying is we just really need to make sure we keep the main thing, and that is those relationships that have gotten us the business. That is just so spot on. And we're talking about workflow processes. I have been selling this, trying to get mortgage bankers' attentions on this forever. And I did a speaking tour. One year I agreed to sign up with the group, and I spoke all over the nation. Every conference they could get me into, spoke at all of them. And I kept saying, you're in the future. You're going to be more known for your processes than your product or pricing. And I came up with that, but I don't know if that was original thought, but it's so true, because he whose process can trump that of your competitor, they're going to have a decided advantage. Because think about long, think of the appraisal thing. If you're taking 6 weeks to get an appraisal, and someone else has solved that through a process change, and they're getting that appraisal done in a week. Does that not have, in this highly competitive world where there's hardly any inventory and someone can get this thing closed? It's such an advantage. They'll pay more in the interest rate. They'll pay more in the fees. They want the home. They're not wanting a mortgage. And what we can do to facilitate that is so important. Jack, I'll let you get a thought on this and then wrap it up with you, Taylor, and then we'll call it a podcast. Jack?
Okay. Well, David, I think you hit it right on the head, right? Efficient process, good technology, speed to close. And then number two, that speed to close is going to help drive a lower cost to originate. And so the investment in technology and process and making sure that those are tightly integrated is going to be the formula for a mortgage bank to be successful as the market recalibrates from 3.5 to 3.8 trillion down to what the latest MBA numbers I saw, David, were 2.3, 2.4 trillion. So if you can differentiate yourself in terms of the rapidity of the process without injecting risk and lower the cost to originate, you're going to find yourself in a good position to still be able to compete successfully in exhausted market.
Exhausted market. That's so good. Taylor, we got to have you back. I love it. Thank you so much for being here, Taylor.
Have me back. I'd love to do it again.
Oh, we're going to do it. Yeah. We got to get the threesome back here. You, Jack, and myself, we'll talk about some more issues. You hit on so many things and they go, please continue with this. Please continue. You got to see the comments coming in. Jack.
David, I've got a final question for Taylor.
All right.
And Taylor, my question is, when you look at what the regulators, the government is doing with regards to CRA, you look at what Ginnie Mae is doing with regard to risk-based tiering of assets mm-hmm. and that risk-based capital ratio, is really the impetus for this to make mortgage banks be regulated the same as depository institutions?
I would love to say yes. I can't defend my yes with much other than my gut instinct. But here's my answer, Jack. I think that banks have largely exited the mortgage business and independent mortgage bankers have replaced them. And so the whole world has looked around and kind of said, hey, the IMBs are doing the loans now. So we better take all the stuff we did with banks and apply it to the IMBs. That's kind of what I feel like is happening, although I don't know that I do a great job debating it with anybody, because the truth is a lot of the bank-like regulations and initiatives and oversight items are now being applied to IMBs. In fact, there are contemporaneous stories about IMBs going through exams, when I say exams, regulatory reviews, by the very state agencies that monitor banks that were applying CRA requirements over mm-hmm. a year ago when there was no CRA requirement that existed, mm-hmm. right? So on an anecdotal basis, we've seen regulators treat IMBs like banks. And listen, I'm not saying there isn't good reason to, because we are now doing the majority of the lending. But I absolutely think that if you're going to do that, you need to look at the regulations. It's not one size fits all. You can't just take all the regulations that apply to banks and apply them to IMBs. You got to say, okay, what was the point of this regulation? Now, how do we make it fit for a privately owned mom and pop style business that has their own personal capital at risk, has no implicit government guarantee, has no access to the federal funds rate, has no access to the federal home loan banking system, and no FDIC insurance. So you have to change. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have new oversight or different oversight, but it has to be based on what makes sense for that business model. And certainly applying bank regulations that came out of the 70s that were based on things that were happening in the 50s to today's IMB makes no sense.
So true. Just heard from one of our listeners, David Crugnelli in Southern California. He says, man, I really love the podcast. It's very valuable information. I know his political leanings. He says, I'm probably not against all the regulations out there, but he says, it reminds me of a proposal years ago in New York where the state regulators wanted to make it a regular requirement for borrowers to give consent for servicing transfer. Then someone pointed out, well, that'll raise the 30-year fixed rate by a quarter point, and the proposal was dropped. I think that's the logic. I think it's, what are the unintended consequences? And all the regulators, and I know we have a lot of you listening to this podcast, we're grateful to have you listening to that. That is such a point. Yes, we're going to have Taylor back. We're going to have Jack on here, and we'll debate this some more. Thank you so much, Taylor, for your generous amount of time you've given us. I tell you, man, I really love listening to you and encourage others to give you voice. And I hope you'll be on many podcasts. Thank you, sir.
Love to. Thank you.
All right, everybody, that wraps it up. Next week, we're going to have on the podcast Richard Toma, who is with the Money Source, going to be here with us. I talked to him earlier. It's going to be a wonderful interview. You'll enjoy it. Also, I want to say a special thank you to our sponsors, Finastra, CMLA, Mortgage Lenders, lenders want, as well as Accelerate, Mobility, MMI, Mortgage Market Intelligence, Modex, MBA, Knowledge Coop, and the Mortgage Collaborative, and SnapDocs, our newest sponsor. Love them. Anyway, thank you so much for being here. Tell others about the podcast. Share this podcast. A lot of great content in here today, and I'll be talking about it on Friday. So come to the Greater Association of Mortgage Lenders in Houston's Friday luncheon. You'll hear me expound on this even more. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a great week. Thank you.
You've been listening to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us next week, and thanks for listening.